For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford, where we try to get beneath the appearances of things to the truths that are there lurking in the back shadows. Well, we all just had 2 days off of work, and I got to admit, Thanksgiving is one of my favorite holidays, and then the day after Thanksgiving is probably one of my least favorite days, just because of the whole Black Friday phenomenon of people heading out, trying to get what they can, and
it's increasingly, Mark, turned into a kind of a pagan festival of materialism and consumerism.
It is, but I'll tell you what, there's a good side to it, and that is the unveiling of all of the technology. So, you know, you get to see the latest cell phones up close. You know, everybody's bringing out sort of the new gadgets and all the great technology. But you know, it's funny because we just got done being thankful for family, being thankful for the freedoms we have, being thankful to God for all the blessings we get. And then we launch into this just almost orgy of technology and science the next day. The dichotomy there. I think there's a deeper philosophical point, and that's why we're here, Tim, to dive in to the deeper philosophical content behind just sort of everyday life.
You know, and that's what makes the Catholic Cave, I think, so much fun to be a part of. And I hear that from listeners too. So, Mark, you know, it seems as if science and technology, we really use those two terms almost interchangeably these days, and we have this confidence that technology is in and of itself good, or at least neutral. It's on this constant advancement towards what? Further and further breakthroughs, revelations. It's going to make things better, faster, smoother. It's going to bring us more capability, more entertainment, all sorts of stuff with it. So we get, as Americans, we really get excited about technology. And I look at my iPhone, I go, wow, this thing's amazing. But there's maybe something else going on too.
I think Black Friday is the perfect example of this because, yes, you know, technology is really, you know, in some ways it's the fruit of scientific, you know, exploration and the exploration of our universe. But instead of that bringing us to a better understanding of God, a better understanding of creation, a better understanding of the universe, and a better understanding of ourselves, technology gets driven by the human will. So technology then drives all of that based upon our desires, based upon what we want and what we can get. And I think that's really where that sort of perversion technology sort of branches off from really what ideally science ought to be, which is a way of understanding our universe to come to a better understanding of ourselves and to come to a better understanding of God.
You know what? We're going to need some help with this topic, Mark, because it sounds like a lot to unpack just right there. And so, you know what? We should bring back on our good friend, Dr. Peter Redpath, invite him back into the cave and help us start getting at what. How does that sound to you?
That sounds great. So let's take a quick break and we'll come right back with Dr. Peter Redpath.
Here at Catholic Radio Indy, we guarantee you will be getting 100% Catholic programming 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Evangelization, catechesis, apologetics, and so much more, all in keeping with the teaching of the Catholic Church. On the air at 89.1 and 90.9 FM, online at catholicradioindy.org, and on the go with a free app for your smartphone or mobile device, Catholic Radio Indy, 100% Catholic programming 24/7.
Okay, cave dwellers, guess what? In our program today, we have Dr. Peter Redpath back. Dr. Redpath, welcome back to the Catholic Cave.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Hey, we had you on the cave here, maybe about a month or so ago, and it was just such a fascinating show. We are really delighted and privileged to have you come back on here. And I know one thing we have got to talk to you about, because I know how interested our audience would be. I know I'm interested. Mark's on the edge of his seat here. And we want to talk to you more about the whole nature of ancient Greek philosophy and really help understand kind of what were they up to, what was the project, and why is it important?
Okay, well, it's grossly misunderstood today by virtually everybody who teaches courses in philosophy what the ancient Greeks were doing. It's very simple. Ancient Greek philosophy grows out of the psychology of the cultural psychology of the ancient Greeks, which grows out of a moral psychology, you know, because we all start are inclined to pursue knowledge, huh, and improve our understanding because we're seeking to be happy. Okay, and so we start to develop different enabling means to do that, including cultural institutions. Huh? And so it was the pursuit of self-understanding, which inclined the ancient Greeks to develop cultural institutions founded on trying to perfect that self-understanding. And this desire to understand themselves, which they had inscribed later on at the temple of the Oracle at Delphi, Know Thyself, inclined them to study the physical universe as an organization. They were fascinated, huh, by organizations. By today, what we would call organizations, or I call operational organizations. The beginnings of philosophy were with this wonder that the ancient Greeks had about the organization of the physical universe and their place in it, as they inclined to investigate this question of what is this organization, this great organization of the universe. They started first with developing productive knowledge, which enhanced their ability to perform human actions.
How does that? Dr. Redpath. Let me jump in and let me ask you. So a couple of quick things. When we're talking ancient Greek philosophy, when are we talking about? We're talking about a period, what, about 2400 years ago?
We're talking about the Poetic Age, actually. Around the time of Homer and Hesiod.
Okay, great. And when we talk about ancient Greeks and in this sort of pursuit of self-understanding, why is that important for us today to even be concerned with something that happened so long ago?
Because the West is losing its self-understanding, as a culture. It has been doing that for several centuries. And that loss of self-understanding is weakening the West as an organizational whole, and causing it to corrode, to die from within.
So could you describe then, in this ancient Greek world, what sort of self-understanding do you think that they were able to attain? And then how is that different? You're talking about an erosion, so we must be moving from one self-understanding to another. What are those self-understandings, or what are some features of that?
Okay, the nature of the ancient Greek self-understanding was that individual human beings have faculties, powers, natural abilities with which we're born, that enable us to know the organization of things and the causes that exist within organizations that incline to generate specific acts.
What's an example of a faculty or power?
The ability to see, the ability to hear, the ability to make choices.
Okay.
To estimate dangers and difficulties.
Okay, great.
Now, you had said something very interesting about the self-understanding and this attempt to come to a understanding of self from the Greeks, that they started with the exploration of nature. They started with the exploration of their universe, which is very different than how modern man tries to go about self-understanding. We look inward. We took a subjective turn some time ago. And I'm curious to hear your opinion of that. Was that a bad move for us to begin to look interiorly for the self-understanding? Or has that been kind of an extension of what the Greeks started with their philosophical project long ago?
Yeah, or is that even your accounting of it?
That was a terrible move. It was totally unnecessary. And it destroyed any possibility of the West understanding philosophy or science, for that matter. Science and philosophy are acts of the human person. They're personal acts. You can't properly understand philosophy or science if you don't understand what a human being is. And so we lost philosophy, the understanding of philosophy, as a personal activity, what Jacques Maritain had called an integral humanism or an integral personalism, which is the starting point of this movement that I've been talking about, of ragamuffin Thomism.
Yes. Tell us about that term. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that it's a kind of initially sloppily and not very precisely developed understanding that something is wrong with the way we've been trying to understand the universe around us and ourselves and the nature of philosophy. This started with, I think, with Maritain initially, and with Etienne Gilson, and with Mortimer Adler, among others, in recognizing that we had to return to a personalist understanding of the nature of philosophy and of science, because science has been transformed not into something that perfects human life, but tortures nature to reveal its secrets.
Right, because with we were talking about that subjective turn. When that happened, we really split. I think the pursuit of philosophy off from the pursuit of science, and you saw this. Aristotle considered himself a natural philosopher, where he was exploring nature for the purpose of coming to a better understanding of human beings, coming to a better understanding of himself. And now we've got this split within the academy where you have scientists that are studying nature and philosophers that are studying knowledge and ethics and morals and all the things that get kind of assigned to philosophy. And so that personalism is a way to bring these two back together.
Yeah, you can't properly understand the methods of philosophy unless you understand habits of the soul, unless you understand that there are qualitatively different kinds of organizations that exist, that have qualitatively different actions that they generate, and have qualitatively different causes of unity, that hold them together and make them strong. The ancient Greeks realized this. They realized that there was a proportion that existed between the qualitative principles and causes that exist within physical organizations and non-physical organizations, even, as well as within the powers of the soul, and the ability to know these organizations, the methods that are used come from different habits of abstraction, habits of induction,
and so in losing
the Greek understanding of the faculty psychology that gives us the methods of the sciences in relationship to different aims or ends, in destroying the notion that there are principles of organization in things, forms in things, that give them their unity and cause qualitatively different kinds of organization, we can't figure out what are the methods,
right,
by means of which properly to study things. And science becomes just this arbitrary arbitrary quest where we don't know how to properly to define a subject or to devise the proper methods for studying it.
So we've reduced down then the you know Aristotle's four causes that he started with, the efficient cause, the formal cause, the material cause, and the final cause. We've reduced that down through the sciences to just simply the material causes of things. And in that, science is kind of...
No, we haven't done that. We've entirely lost the notion of cause. What we've done is we've replaced the notion of cause with a law. Externally imposed. We've made material things totally inert. The Cartesian worldview, matter is just extension. There's no activity in it whatsoever. So there's nothing internal in it that makes it intelligible. God has imposed laws externally on the physical universe, and the only one who knows those laws, supposedly, is the mathematician.
So we moved from
So if you want to study the behavior of physical things, including human beings, you can only do that by means of the mathematical method and the mathematical way of imagining things. Now, mathematics works terrific when you're dealing with dimensive bodies, when you're dealing with figured bodies, geometrical figures, and so forth, and you want to use technology to constrain behavior. But it's totally worthless when you're dealing with social and political organizations, which have a different kind of qualitative unity that holds them together, that requires a different method of imagining. Right?
Well, let me jump in and play. Let me play devil's advocate on that point, Dr. Redpath, because my experience is that has been when I look at the media, read the news, that sort of stuff. There's a lot of emphasis in the culture around polling. About majorities. So it seems as if as long as the majority percent of people find things to be a certain way, well, then that is the way things are. But you're describing something completely different.
Well, for the ancient Greeks, first of all, organizations, the order of the universe, has always existed and always will exist. The question whether or not the world exists, the universe exists, and it's intelligible to ordinary human beings was a ridiculous question to the ancient Greeks. We have natural faculties, natural abilities to know the organization of things, as well as the organization of our own faculties, our own powers. Having lost that faculty psychology, there's no way in which we can explain how any individual causes science. Because we've withdrawn powers and ability from the individual. In addition to that, we took truth out of the human intellect. Each of the major thinkers of the Enlightenment, and even that prior to that, this age that's supposedly pure reason, is nothing of the sort. It's an age of pure will. When René Descartes, the founder of modern, the father of modern philosophy, talks about clear and distinct ideas, he's talking about ideas that are produced by a strong will, by the ability on the part of a will. He talks about this in his fourth meditation, that truth and that falsity lies in the wandering imagination that's unable to focus on an idea because it doesn't have the proper idea of God.
Right, and prior to that, the understanding of how we came to truth was we had a correspondence between our intellect and the form of the thing that we're beholding or the idea of the thing that we're beholding that through our faculties we're able to abstract and then recognize that universal concept that there's in front of us. And then when you get to Descartes, suddenly that whole faculty psychology has been really abandoned.
It gets destroyed, and philosophy essentially depends on it. You can't have philosophy, you can't have science without this. If you divorce science from the faculty psychology, you divorce science from contributing to the pursuit of human happiness as a facultative being. As a rational animal, you abandon what Etienne Gilson in his Unity of Philosophical Unity of Philosophical Experience calls the Western Creed, this firm conviction on the part of the ancient Greeks that the physical universe is intelligible, that it has an internal truth which consists in the internal organization, the part-whole relationships that are the proximate causes of the action of these things.
And none of that
we have a natural ability by means of natural reasoning, unaided by mathematical technologies, to know these principles, and mathematical technologies can improve our ability to know these principles in specific areas, but not in everything. The modern sophists tell us that who are posing as philosophers, they say they take this positivistic attitude that the whole of truth lies in mathematical physics, and anything outside of mathematical physics is opinion emotionally held. Now, that's no different from saying that the whole of truth exists in Scripture or the whole of truth exists in the Quran. Right? It's no more defensible. It's a fundamentalistic claim, and it's the reason why when they talk about science, they talk about it as a belief system. But supposedly it's an enlightened belief system because they are participating, just like Descartes is participating in revelation from God that stabilizes his will so that his reason can look at things clearly. So for modern thinkers like Hobbes or like Locke or like Rousseau, we get truth by stabilizing our will under the rule of the Leviathan or under the general will or the legislative will.
Right, because to a certain extent, the rule, the will, honestly, the framework within empirical science takes place is now divorced from the natural world, and it's divorced from natural observation of an ordered universe, because that ordered universe, that's not an empirical fact. That's not something you can observe. That's something you have to deduce really from another field outside of science.
Right. Now, what's happened is that we've separated the act of science from an activity of abstraction, from qualitatively different methods of abstraction, methods of induction, okay, by means of which we understand that qualitative unity that's distinctive to this or that. That's what's the characteristic of induction. Sir Francis Bacon understood in his Organon that there was something wrong with the notion of induction in his own age. And he recognized it needed to be corrected. But the notion he said logicians presuppose induction. Logicians can't tell you the nature of induction. He warned that if you don't understand induction properly, then by the time you get to logic, you're just going to reason consistently, and if you made a mistake, you're just going to make more mistakes. You're going to compound them.
But at least they'll be consistent.
Yeah, now, right. Now, we've lost our understanding of induction because we've separated it from the faculty psychology that enables qualitatively different powers and abilities of abstraction to occur that reveal to people familiar with different kinds of organizations what gives them their qualitative unity among their parts.
Yeah, I think one way that people see this is when you start to read Thomas Aquinas, you start to read the Summa, you go through, the language is a little bit difficult to get through, but once you get past the language, you start to realize he's starting from a standpoint of common sense. He's starting from a standpoint of kind of natural observations that anybody and everybody can make. And then he proceeds through deduction and induction towards higher truths. But he starts from what's accessible to us most immediately. And that's a huge difference, I think, than the empirical science, which in some ways almost is a reversal of that.
Yeah, all of the ancient Greeks were sense realists. This notion that some of the ancient Greeks were sense realists, and then afterwards they changed, is false. Even Plato is a sense realist. He starts his reasoning from sensation, and all of them were trying to figure out what is the principle of unity that exists within a multitude, that gives it order, that gives it organization, that produces a harmony within it that generates qualitatively different actions.
Right, and to be able to move from that multiplicity that you get through sense experience to that unity, you have to have the faculty psychology to be able to really connect, honestly, the empirical world of sense that we see to the real world to a great extent of that sort of organized and organization that sort of underlies reality.
Right, yep. That's what St. Thomas calls a formal object or the subject of a science. The ancient Greeks, St. Thomas recovered this understanding that was in Aristotle, of the nature of a formal object, of the subject of a science. The subject of a science is that which stimulates, it's the organizational whole that stimulates a facultative response, like a colored being, a being with color, stimulates the faculty of sight. An audible being stimulates, causes a reaction in the faculty of hearing. So to the extent that you have different faculties and have habits within those faculties that can perfect the imagining and judging abilities on the part of a human being related to different ways of imagining and judging, you have different sciences.
Well, I've always wondered too, with modern science being so based upon just sort of the collection of empirical data, I've often wondered, okay, given technology, given the state of sort of the empirical sciences right now, what would a rational science that's based upon the faculty psychology that we've abandoned and jettisoned, what would a rational science really kind of look like?
Well, it would look like one in which a person is imagining, first of all, in different ways, the kinds of parts that exist within a whole that are either generating a unity, a kind of unity. In other words, how do you make this kind of figured body or that kind of figured body? Okay, what kind of parts, and how do they have to be related in order to be able to do that? Or how do you generate an act? What kind of parts must exist within this being that generate this or that disease, like a physician would imagine. If you want to understand St. Thomas's understanding of science and science properly understood, just read the first his first lesson. The beginning of his first lesson is commentary on Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. He explains it right there, like he says in the Summa Contra Gentiles. The office of the wise man is to set things in order and govern them well.
Right.
It's to understand organization. It's to understand.
And scientific exploration would then happen within the context of sort of a teleological hierarchy of the sciences that kind of sets that order.
It happens within a teleology, because the only way you can unify a multitude, order a multitude, is to the extent that you have unequally qualified abilities that are common, unequally related to a common act, to an end. You destroy the notion of an end. You eliminate the notion of an end, which the modern world has done, and you can't make intelligible how there's any internal principle of unity, which is why they had to replace this notion of form in things with laws, because coming out of the Reformation, you had Augustinians who wanted God to be the only cause. Both Catholic and Protestant Augustinians.
Yeah, we used to joke about,
Because of all action in the universe, and they wanted to get rid of the notion of secondary causes.
Right. We used to joke that when we took our oral exams in grad school, that any question that was asked, the answer was Augustine, because you could always take that back. Any question about Augustine, the answer was God, because you could always take any Augustinian question back to God. And that's exactly what you're saying, that Augustinian impulse to sort of bring everything really back to, you know, make everything into God to a certain extent.
Understanding the principles of unity that hold organizations together is the quality of leadership. Right? It's an essential property of leadership. If the only methods by means of which you can understand organizations is by means of mathematics and mathematical technologies, and if everything outside of this kind of way of imagining things and reasoning about things is an opinion, emotionally held, an emotionally held opinion, that means this mindset that we've inculcated in our colleges and university students over the past more than a century has produced anarchists.
Well, that's why I wanted to, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a very contemporary issue. As we're here having, you know, recording the show, there seem to be uprisings on various campuses. What's your make of that? What's the cause of that? What's going on there, Dr. Redpath?
That's a symptom of the disordered minds of the professors. Mortimer Adler in 1940 wrote an article called "God and the Professors." It was published in Harper's Magazine, and another one he wrote called "This Pre-War Generation," in which he talked about the fact that the Western civilization, Western culture, was dying from within because of the mindset of the professors. He talked about this at a conference held in New York City on science, philosophy, and religion, and he said that the conference could not possibly succeed because it had the wrong topic. What they should be studying was not philosophy, science, and religion, but the professors of philosophy, science, and religion, who didn't understand any of these fields, because they were positivists, they were sophists. Huh? The whole of truth is contained in mathematical physics, and outside of that is just mere opinion. And as a result, they were unable to defend the superiority of Western culture and Western cultural principles over attacks on them, especially on liberal democracy. Huh?
Yeah, I think, you know, the whole world to a certain extent has been talking about that lately, of the inability to defend the truths of Western culture, because they've devolved into just sort of opinions being pitted, you know, one opinion against another opinion against another opinion. And those who are the most powerful to a certain extent are the ones that prevail in these contests.
Of course, because science is the will to power. If your students, he said, were being educated for success, given a vocational education like sophists, to just pursue money and political power, and they weren't being trained. They were being trained to think that the whole purpose of a college and university education is to get a job, rather than to understand the principles by means of which you become a leader. Which are located in this classical understanding of philosophy and science that have been increasingly lost from the West. And so I mentioned this to you last time. He said that he said that the professors were worse than Hitler, because at least Hitler was honest and understood what he was doing.
Oh, jeez. Hey, how does this sound?
He said that the students resembled Nazi youth, the American students, not because of this love of the fatherland, but precisely because of this cultural equivalence that they held, because they maintained that there were no real goods that were intelligible, that could be understood,
other
than with the methods of physical science. And so to be judgmental was to try to force their opinions on other people. This explains the mindset of leading from behind within leaders today, which was not the mindset of the ancient Greeks. The ancient Greeks were convinced that qualitative greatness, different orders of qualitative greatness, existed within the physical universe and within human beings, and that by possessing virtues, we were able to achieve a kind of qualitative greatness, which is what they wanted. And this was these were the foundational principles of the Western Creed. The ancient Greeks thought themselves to be great, huh?
Right?
Qualitatively great. That they had a great role to play in the universe. That they wanted to perfect this greatness in themselves and within all people that they could influence. Right? That notion of being culturally great to an enlightened mind. That's ridiculous.
Right, right.
Right. But that brings us really back to Gilson and Maritain and
Vladimir Putin things, you see, because
right. Right.
Real enlightened leaders are convinced that you have to take a vote from other people who've never been trained to understand how organizations are actually put together and taken apart, but they have sincere feelings. They share a common will. In other words, they are Rousseau's Emile. Huh?
Right.
They're a child of pure goodwill and sincere feelings. And because they all will the same things with the pure goodwill, they're convinced that they couldn't possibly be wrong. So they take a vote, agree with about what they're doing, and they consider that to be the science of man.
Or the
true religion, actually. It's a kind of religious impulse based upon the religion of humanity, see?
Yeah.
The true religion that enlightened intellectuals believe in. It's like the hidden church, the invisible church that Renaissance humanists and certain reformers talked about.
Or what about the anonymous Christian? That I think was Rahner's term. That was one of the ones that always struck me kind of odd, that you could be a Christian anonymously. But I want to bring us back to before we run out of time.
This is the mindset of the German cardinals.
It is now. Yeah, it is. I would agree with you. I think it's certainly manifesting itself in with the dissenting ones.
Yeah, it sounds like with the Pope's last ad limina visit with the German bishops, that he's kind of realizing that as well.
Right. Hey, bring us back around, Dr. Redpath, to, because this has really been fascinating. Before our audience, bring us back around now to, we're in this sort of crisis of truth where it seems like we're in the West. And Europe is in Western civilization. Europe's in a period of rapid decline culturally. So, and you mentioned this term ragamuffin Thomist. Can you tie these things together for us?
Sure. This ragamuffin Thomism is based upon the conviction that the human person is a principle of truth. That science, that philosophy, in some way grow out of the human person, and perfection and self-understanding, wisdom, and so forth. This conviction started to be emphasized by Maritain and then by Gilson and by Adler. But they hadn't connected it, and also by Pope Benedict. A lot of the Thomists in the 20th century didn't realize this. They totally separated Thomism, in a way, from this faculty psychology. They subliminally, implicitly, they understood it, but they didn't bring it in. To understanding the divisions and the methods of the science.
Right. Did the study of phenomenology, so the study of kind of how the brain and how the human being, how the human person interacts with our experiences, did that set the stage for this ragamuffin Thomism? Was that kind of a necessary first step?
Well, in a way it is, but not Husserlian phenomenology, the kind of phenomenology where Father Sokolowski is engaged in it.
Right. You know, yeah, okay. Yeah, and John Paul II and kind of his whole entree into phenomenology.
Because unless you have an awareness of the fact that you possess reliable sense faculties, and you can reliably describe on the sense level the an organization, you can. Imagine the part-whole relationships that exist within it on the imaginary level. That's the phenomenological level. Huh? You can't abstract the concept related to the organization within things. You see, now somebody like John Locke says, "Substance, I know not what it is." Okay, now a substance is simply an operational organization. Huh?
Gotcha.
The human body, right? As a health generating organism, huh?
Right?
Substance. Locke's a physician. He says, "Hey, I don't know what a health communicating organization is." Well, then he doesn't know what a body is. He doesn't know what a living body is, huh? Would you go to this man as a doctor?
Yeah, because
in other words, the Enlightenment thinkers take the principles of unity and organization out of physical things, right? And they claim that their particular method of imagining the universe imposes those principles on things.
It's kind of the ghost within the machine, I think, is what they ultimately come to. Whether it's the human soul or whether it's God, they kind of see.
David Hume says these are feelings that you have, that things are united. There really is no unity in things. Immanuel Kant says these are categories of the understanding. You see, because Kant is Germanic, right? He wants to put this in a very technical language. So you want to understand. The lack of profundity of the thought. Huh? You make the language sound profound, and supposedly you're supposed to be impressed.
Yeah, precise ignorance is still ignorance.
Yeah. In other words,
I love that.
The whole of the Enlightenment was claiming that there are no principles or causes of unity in things existing outside of our mind or even in ourselves. Huh? As a result, we have no self-knowledge. We can't know ourselves. Right?
We certainly can't know other people. Then
collections of disconnected feelings, and we can't understand the organization and things. They're skeptics and solipsists.
Right. Yeah. Let me ask you this. Let me ask you this real quick.
They are leaders.
Hey, Dr. Redpath. Let me ask you this. What do you make of? That's a great prelude to this. I think I'm wondering, what's your take on this attack? We see increasingly attack on free speech, that there's this overriding climate of political correctness. We have to create safe zones for
right.
people, you know,
right.
and now I'm told I have to watch out for my microaggressions, that I might be here,
yeah,
you know, flinging
way,
those at Mark
Jonathan
and Ken.
Haidt.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know,
now, Jonathan Haidt is just the type of person who produces this mentality in people. He's one of the scoundrels, which are the chief causes, one of the professors that Adler was talking about, because Haidt thinks that there is no truth in things, strictly speaking, that the reason you perceive truth is to manipulate people. He thinks that David Hume is the one who actually understood the nature of ethics. Huh? Hume thinks there are no causes in things.
Right.
Yeah, he's
a moron.
Yeah,
huh?
Yeah. He thinks morality is all pre-rational, that you somehow innately come to your moral judgments, and then reason provides, you know, the reasons behind things.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, he gives an attack on Plato. He never read Plato in any depth whatsoever. He doesn't understand what he's talking about, misinterprets him, engages in all sorts of gross misinterpretations. But the reason for this is that with modernity, a reversal occurred in the relationship between knowledge and science. Prior to Descartes, knowledge presupposed science. After Descartes, science knowledge presupposes science.
Right, right.
You have to have science to have knowledge.
Yeah.
Okay? So the only people who understand freedom and free speech are the people who share enlightened feelings. And they can't tolerate listening to people with non-enlightened feelings.
Right. And so it all just turns back to that great big power game of who
this is why Barack Obama, for example, President Obama, he leads from behind.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, I'm quite sure my feelings are not enlightened. So
he can't listen. Like Emil, he can't listen to people with unenlightened feelings. Huh?
Right,
the
right.
People who think, you know, for example, there's such a thing as one culture being greater than another or one religion being greater than another, when the only true religion is enlightened religion, huh?
Right.
You know, this is the religion of true Islam. This is the religion of true Christianity. I mean, how can we possibly abuse war with true Islam when true Islam is enlightened religion? Huh?
Yeah. Yeah, there's the turn.
Yeah,
of love of humanity.
And to take it once,
which is the enlightened religion of utopian socialists.
Right, which is going to dictate and tell the other religious beliefs whether their beliefs are right and wrong according to this
that,
enlightened.
You see, they think that religion has something to do with rituals. Huh? That it has something to do with pursuing some kind of difference of greatness. It doesn't embrace the notion of tolerance. There is no such thing as qualitatively different goods and evils. We're all equally good and evil, and we're all equally dumb. You see, outside of physical science, you know nothing.
Yeah.
Whatsoever. And so we get the truth about definition from our politicians.
Right. Yep.
Because they are trained in social science from people like Jonathan Haidt to get the principles by means of which we have right definition, huh?
Because
which is evolved through human consciousness from backward stages of nature. Huh?
Right. Because our natural inclination to observe, to investigate the universe, etc., can't possibly lead us to the true, the beautiful, the good, the transcendentals, because those things just simply don't exist.
You see, what they're doing is they're taking a professional class, okay, of individuals, and they're taking their methods of talking, huh? Their professional language, and they're replacing the act of abstraction with their professional jargon. In other words, they're saying that these people replace the natural habit of abstraction of the human mind that improves people's ability to be scientific and to perfect other different kinds of sciences, huh? And this means that. And that there's only one science, strictly speaking, and these people have the understanding of the human person, huh? That is the founding principle for understanding. It's metaphysics, basically, huh?
Right. We've talked
the metaphysics for modern for this unjustifiable claim is based upon fairy tale history.
Right,
and fairy tale history is the metaphysics of the Enlightenment.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I mean, we've talked several times here in the Catholic Cave about sort of a crisis in metaphysics or a bankruptcy. So we've got a couple of minutes left, Dr. Redpath. Can we turn this tide of declination of our culture? Can we turn that around? And if we can, what might be a way to do that?
The only way you can turn it around is by returning to this classical self-understanding of the ancient Greeks. This is why Renaissances in Western culture always return to the Greeks. They always return to the faculty psychology, right? To the conviction that ordinary human beings have knowing faculties that are adequate, that are capable of understanding the organizational principles that exist within things around us. That the world is not irrational, you know, and so forth. That it gets rid of the skepticism, right? Without getting rid of that skepticism, without restoring that faculty psychology, without restoring the understanding that there are qualitatively different organizations in the universe that are knowable by us, then there's no way you can get out of this cystic trap, in which the solipsism and the skepticism, that's the foundation of the misnamed enlightenment, and this whole attempt on the part of the church to engage in a new evangelization will be a total failure.
And that's where the Catholic personalism, you know, the ragamuffin Thomism, the thought of Sokolovsky, of John Paul II, of Maritain, of Gilson, of these guys of trying to return us to that faculty, that faculty psychology.
They tried to, but none of them achieved it. Okay, Gilson didn't understand the relationship of the formal object to the faculty psychology. Maritain didn't understand it, and Adler didn't explicitly understand it either. The first person who started to understand this was Armand Maurer at the Pontifical Institute of Medieval Studies, as far as I can see. And this was a missing piece. Implicitly, they understood it. Okay, they understood this relationship between human faculties and science, but they hadn't had the explicit understanding of how this was all connected to habits of abstraction. I start to talk about this in that book of mine, A Not So Elementary Christian Metaphysics on Reuniting Philosophy and Science and Science and Wisdom, which is really the beginnings of this movement to maturely develop this understanding of this born again Thomism or ragamuffin Thomism. And I've just finished a second volume on it, which I guess will be published in a few months.
Fantastic. Now we're just about out of time, Dr. Redpath. So thank you for sharing. Those are some of your contemporaries. You know, if people want to get a hold of you or want to learn more about some of your projects and interests, how can they do that?
One way they can do it is through the Adler Aquinas Institute. They can go online to check that out. They can check out my Aquinas School of Leadership. If they do a search for the Aquinas School of Leadership, they can email me there. I've got a list of principles, for example, for solving these problems right at the on my homepage.
Well, that's fantastic. You know, we can't thank you enough for joining us again here on the Catholic Cave. This has been a fantastic and fascinating walk through ancient Greeks all the way up to some of the contemporary issues that we're facing today. So thank you once again. We look forward to having you back real soon.
Okay, good. Happy to be with you.
The Great Lakes Gabriel Project is an ever-growing Christian-based network of church volunteers standing together in their commitment to offer assistance to women and families facing difficult or unplanned pregnancies.
I'm Eileen Hartman with Great Lakes Gabriel Project. If you're interested in volunteering to help this life-affirming effort, please go to our website, goangels.org, for more information.
Wow, Tim, Dr. Redpath certainly gave us some food for thought there. And given that it was just Thanksgiving, and I don't know about you, but I think I had more food than I can digest, let's leave this for a week. We'll digest what Peter Redpath has given us, and we'll come back and discuss this in future shows.
Sounds great.
All right, so from the Catholic Cave, we're wishing all of you a happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at catholicradioindy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at catholicradioindy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.